This is entirely a pedagogy of first impression. So you can all tell me afterwards how it worked, but you can see there's one concrete measure of improvement already. There are page numbers.
Yeah.
And strawberry jelly.
That's depends which one. That's the river of blood. That's those two.
River of blood.
No, it's strawberry. Right?
I think Yaakov said that, Avi said his had a river because the paper was creased. So I told him there was an alternative.
The paper's creased on all of them.
Okay. So,
can you ever stop criticizing? I love the page numbers.
I like the page numbers too.
Excellent.
I'm criticizing the crease in the sheet.
Okay, come on.
Okay, here we go. What I'm going to do is
I'm going to teach you
very quickly one of the tests that we didn't do yesterday. Before that, let's start with the broader methodological introduction. So we pointed out yesterday that there are a whole bunch of texts. Each of those texts contains a whole bunch of cases. Each of those cases can be understood a whole bunch of ways. Each of those ways can be applied a whole bunch of ways. And that's assuming you treat them individually. Of course, they interact. Right? So generally, a reasonably straightforward sugya involving a single extended text can generate, can generally minimally somewhere between 1,024 and, 30,000 possibilities as to what it means, which you just do by iterative options, and the options interrelate. One of the early shurim I gave after being a Rosenzweig shurim was sort of a reaction to, both was called 1,024 ways to understand Chatzi Shir and which one Tosfot holds. Right, you set up, there's this click here, and this click here, and this click here, and this click here, and this has three possibilities and two possibilities, and it gets up to 1,024 pretty rapidly. And then I tried to prove, which one a particular Tosfot and Yoma held. Because you have that many possibilities, so then what do you do with them? That was my reaction, because Rosenzweig didn't care so much about, Rosenzweig's interest in setting up 1,024 possibilities. But when you get to a halachic sugya, to a halachic topic, which requires bringing many sugya together and the commentaries in each one, you can easily get up into the seven figures of possibilities and probably more. So the challenge, is figuring out how you cull and how you manage to put the information together. First of all, because there are so many texts and not everybody can hold all those texts together. So some people reduce text to ideas, and you can hold multiple ideas in your head. Some people, it's better as a mnemonic to think about what the text means. Some people create outlines.
Wait.
Pardon?
It's better as a mnemonic to think about what the text means.
Yeah, some people just say...
So far I've said the text, then now the text is merely a mnemonic for the possibilities of its applications.
If you're trying to organize all the information, yes.
That's what the Gemara is.
We started out with the text and it means something, and now the information is just the possibilities. Now we've gone back to the thing that was supposed to have meaning and made it merely
in the
mnemonic.
Yes.
That's what the Gemara is.
If you're a brisker.
Now, I think that, that to some extent the difference between thinking l'halacha, thinking academically, and thinking yeshivishly, in a sense, thinking briskerly, right? So thinking briskerly, if you're the extreme of Rosenzweig version, so then it doesn't really, when you think a text is merely mnemonic, because it doesn't really matter which meaning is more probable. If you're thinking halachically, then I think you have to think about which meaning is more probable. So if you think about a text is not a mere mnemonic for five possible meanings, it's a mnemonic for a 50% possibility of this meaning and 20% that meaning and 10% that meaning.
You have to keep all that in your head as well.
So you have to figure out how to cut. Right, with any really complex topic, you have to figure out, let's say, philosophic topics that get too complex for me, that's what I use poetry for. Right, poetry is a way of thinking about vast amounts of information through symbols, so you don't actually have to keep every element. We'll talk Friday, right, that you need techniques like multiplication. Multiplication is a really cool technique, which lets you add vast amounts of numbers at the same time. Right, that's what it does. Right, and once you know about multiplication, so then you can control vastly longer streams of numbers than you could have before. right? Because somebody can say 6 times 6 plus 4 times 4, where you can never keep your 6 plus 6 plus 6 plus 6 plus, right? You can't do that. So we have it. Right? So we use numbers and symbols as mnemonics, and so you need to find parallel ways of controlling Talmudic information. You have a bunch of basic organizing principles, right? You have a text, which is an organizing principle. You have a case, which is an organizing principle. You can have a concept, which is an organizing principle. Right, so those are tactics you have to do, and you have to figure out how to cut. Part of this is a methodological issue, and if you come out of the Gush school, or you're trained that way, so then you're what used to be an old selection method, which was only to do a certain limited set of commentaries, went out the window because now you read everything. So you need a couple of things, right? To do that method, you need to figure out, which Rav Rosenzweig always thought was an important skill of his to teach. You need to figure out how to rapidly skim Rishonim and compare and contrast as opposed to reading everything through, because otherwise it's overwhelming. Now I always fought Rav Rosenzweig on that. I think the one line that I don't think he denies, right, was he said you should learn to read Rishonim the way you read a newspaper. Right, the headline tells you whether this is an article you have to read, and then you read the lead, and you only go in depth in certain things. So I thought you have to that is a really valuable skill, but you better be able to actually read before you learn to skim. And that was the controversy I had some point about pedagogic methodology. Yes, Shida.
I was thinking if you read like that, then you can't remember. And B, what if you like actually like you have to read carefully in order to make sure they never see this.
Right. So I have a lot of critique of the people who just read that way. At the same time, if you read every Rishon really, really closely, then you will never get through your first sugya. Right. And this is before you start reading Tshuvot. Right. So we have to figure right. So if you're going to take that method, you have to figure right. You have to develop a method for obtaining the information with some degree of rapidity, and then a method for organizing the incredible amount of information you have, and you have to do it with your own intellectual capacity. Rav Rosenzweig's, most amazing, mental gymnastic skill is what I call intellectual battleship. Like you line up 50 chakiras this way and 50 chakiras that way, and then you say, C7, and he gives you the nafkamina. automatically, right? And that's not a skill that there are probably 30 people in the world who have ever been able to have. And so, so to train yourself to do that, really, you're not, unless you just have an incredible capacity to pull that off, which means that you can really, every text that you read is automatically cataloged conceptually, and all the interactions are automatic, right? Work automatically. So then, that's not what you're going to do. So you have to figure out a different way of making the material that you learn for a shiur useful. If you're not ready, if that's not what you're going to be able to do, so that's everyone has to figure out their own strengths and how you account for your own weaknesses, which is all the educational rage. Now, anyway, yes, Chaim.
Maybe that's why
could be because it just took too long, right? And we're going to at some point, the amount of information that comes from a single Bar Ilan search now is so enormous, right? It takes so much more to know a topic thoroughly than it did 70 years ago, that either the field will call out all people who don't have extremely rapid reading skills and the capacity to skim well, or we'll have to figure out methodologies where it turns out it doesn't really matter what Rav Baruch Sfardi says.
You're assuming there are people in the middle who actually care what Baruch Sfardi says.
Of course, all of you now already are deeply impressed with Baruch Sfardi. You would never consider skipping Baruch Sfardi at any other sugya, I imagine. Don't disabuse me. yes, Tobin.
Like, this is what people do for PhD qualifying exams, right? You research a topic so well that, and then you stand up before a committee that'll, question you are the most going to hear. I'll ask you what Rebecca already said. And you have to know it, because that's what we set, the standard that we've set for academic rigor. I'm not sure why we should give people a pass, just because there's a lot of information.
But those are central
details. That's one topic. That's not,
right.
Everything.
People spend their whole... No, I mean, I don't know. That's like my friend who's getting her PhD in Near Eastern Languages and Civilization. Yeah, she has one focus, but she has to know many, many, many more things than just that one focus.
Yeah, well, I have a friend who's doing that too, but he has to do his 100 books. And it's 100 central books. There are lots of central books.
Yeah, so like reading 500 books and being reading 400, 300 books in a semester and not.
So the question: if the standard for serious learning is going to be the standard for a PhD at a really serious program, right? So it's not terrible. We should acknowledge that. And it goes on through life. Like, you know, people get their PhDs and then they're, you know, and that's pretty much the end, the last time they do that in many ways, unless it's a book.
I mean, you keep reading, you have to stamp it on the research in your area.
Which is great. You know, figure out how many scholars there are who really meet that in a given field. And then figure out that that we're supposed to know halacha fairly comprehensively.
See, anyone who wants to learn Arabic can go learn Arabic. But if you want to be like a scholar of Arabic Sufi poetry in, you know, the 300 or whatever, then this is what it takes.
Okay.
No, but also it's much more special. Usually the rabbi gave two drashas a
year. Okay. I'm okay setting the standard that high. And to some degree that's, you know, because my ideal standards come from Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, who lived in both worlds. But at the same time, I can tell you that the other professors in the field say that his standards are unmeetable. Yes, sir?
Can you define what you mean when you say reading the text as in the manner?
Not reading a text. I think that one of the ways in which you can organize last information is if you think about, right, you think about this text, and when you think about this text, that immediately calls to mind the seven interpretations of that text. So you don't have to think of 35 different interpretations in your head directly. You can write your first, right, the text becomes like the number six is an agglomerate of six ones, so the text becomes a way of remembering all the interpretations.
Okay.
Right.
What's the methodology of doing that?
Of remembering?
Of sort of looking at a text and sorting it.
That's if you, right, if you think that way. Right. Either you think that way or you don't.
No, that's true. Memory, you can train your...
And they're also right. So I'm not a memory trainer. I'll just tell you that, you know, the simple thing about this, you know, that my statement about Chazal's magnificent educational technique is the way you want, if you want people to remember things, you have to pick something they know already really well, so they don't have to memorize, so they don't have to memorize the mnemonic. And then you try and attach as much information as you can to that mnemonic, but it has to be a long mnemonic, otherwise too much information gets tied into every single symbol. And it has to... And you can't be a mnemonic that you use for everything else, or you'll get confused that way. So imagine if you had a book, which is pretty long, and imagine that everyone reviews this book in its totality once a year, and then you try and fit the entire culture. You make that book a mnemonic for an entire culture.
It's like choose your own
Torah
adventure games.
No, what it is Torah Shebal Peh. Right? There's this book called Torah. Everyone's supposed to know it by heart because we review it every year. Everyone has to read it at least once a year. Ideally, they're supposed to actually read it twice a week and make sure they know its meaning another time, right? And then they hear it read publicly. So actually, right, it's actually they're reviewing this book four times a year. And then you attach everything else in Jewish culture to that book. So every time you read that book, you remember, right? You remember these things, and eventually you can transmit an entire culture. All right, that's what Chazal's educational technique is. That's what that's I think what Torah Shebal Peh is designed to accomplish. Avi doesn't like it.
It's baldly ahistorical.
Baldly ahistorical. Yes.
I think it's also, I don't know, it doesn't account for, it says that Midrash is merely mnemonic. Like, if you take one side of an issue as Midrash is mnemonic and not generative.
No, I'm not. Taking both sides.
That's exactly what you said.
Because the things that are generated by the text, of course the text will be mnemonic for them.
That's what Torah Shebal Peh is, the work.
Torah Shebal Peh is the whole, and the way you transmit it is by attaching the whole, both the things that are generated by the text and the things that are not generated by the text, to the text.
And then there are things that are, firstly the whole year thing, then we have smaller issues, which are like the whole year thing doesn't apply to all the stuff that's attached to Nach. Then you have things that are attached to nothing.
We have the triennial cycle.
We try our best.
Triennial cycle. Then you have Mishnayot and Breitot. You have Halachot L'Moshe Mitzinai. We have Sfaravu. It's like there's more going on, and it doesn't account for the way that learning actually took place in the early.
Okay, so this is a longer conversation. I'm not bothered by triennial cycles, so you review it every 3 years.
Okay.
It's the best you can. I'm not bothered by Nach, because they did the best they could. They couldn't attach everything. They tried their best, and when they couldn't attach it to Chumash, right, their best thing was Yesh Min HaMikra, Min HaRei. That's the best thing, when you can get mnemonics that are redundant and all over the place. But and the things they attach it to are going to be, in many, right, I think you'll probably find that Haftorahs have a much higher percentage. of things attached to them. Right? Other things are used liturgically. Right? We'll have a higher percentage of things attached to them because those are familiar. And you remember svara because svaras will be placed in the right. Even if you say lama likra svarahu, so that svara will now be attached to that kra in your head because you remember lama likra svarahu. I don't mind that at all, but we could.
Fine, it's historical. That's the whole. That's where we started.
Well, we have to figure out who the Chazal is. Let's not go there. We have a much longer, claim.
Most importantly,
it's from Chazal, which doesn't do that.
Do you have a path to only spend 10 minutes on the Tefillin every single day?
Do you have a path to what?
Only spend like 8 minutes on the Tefillin and remember everything.
No, that's you have to go to a Sabbata for that.
Who?
That's Sabbata, right? Doesn't he give the 20-minute Tefillin share? I believe so. I think it's not Rasabata at Maladimim, but his brother, no? Or is it him? That gives a 20-minute Daf Yomi. We'll see. We'll talk about Friday. Like there might actually be a way to do it, but I haven't done it yet. Pardon? Well, the Vilagon probably could do that, right? Probably everything was okay. So here's what I do. We're gonna read. So I thought just today I would give you just a brief exercise that may work for you, may not work for you. That will illustrate what I was saying about Tosfot yesterday and possibly think of, right, present ways of beginning to organize large amounts of material. So here's the Tosfot HaRosh from Bava Metzia. We didn't do it yesterday. He's on the line, Mavir no Tahimena. Mavir no Tahimena, right, that's his base text, we'll call that zero, right, and that's the case where somebody falls on the Peah or spreads his talus over it, right? So what he says is, V'hadetani bani zakin, but that which we learned in Masechet Gittin, the case of, right, that's case one, the case of the poor person shaking the olive tree on top, which is Gezel Mipnei Darkei Shalom, that case is different because the Tarach Batvei, because he, right, because that case, unlike the case of the falling on the Peah, in that case he put a lot of effort into it. Okay, then he says case two, which is a case we didn't bother doing, which is the case about finding lost objects for somebody else. And right, for the Gemara, in that case suggests that just looking at something is hefker, that is hefker is sufficient to acquire it. So certainly falling on it should be enough, right? So he doesn't start from the Dalad Amos Shel Adam Konoslo, right? He starts from a different place, which says mere eyesight is sufficient to show it. He says no, that's also a case Shetarach Batarach Meruba Kedepreshi Pareish Michiltin. That case, which we don't even know anything about, that's also a case of great effort. So what he tells you is that. When somebody puts in effort, the rabbis will find ways to recognize acquisition and create zones of non-interference. But if you don't put in effort, the rabbis are less inclined to generate these zones of non-interference.
How's looking at it great effort?
Looking at it is not great effort, but looking at it comes as the result of effort.
Because you went to find it?
No, you have to know the whole case there, which we don't care about. Okay. Then he says, Avahacha, right, that's back to case zero, right? Lo tarach, but here, in the case of falling on the Peah, you haven't put any effort in at all. Okay, new, case three. V'hadam rinam b'kiddushin, ani mahapech b'charara, uva acher v'nat lo yimenu nikra rasha. So now we get the Rabbeinu Tam speech. Omer Rabbeinu Tam, delav hainu charara shel hefker v'shel matana, ela osa bischar etzeb lo balabayis. Right, so the case of the ani mahapech b'charara means that he is working for a salary. Right, why? She'acholim solis takir b'makom acher, because he could find a way to be hired somewhere else. And the same thing he says is true of a purchase. You shouldn't go buy something that another person is trying to buy. Because he can, well, you can buy it somewhere else. And that is his way, I didn't give it a number, but that's his way of dealing with the case of Rav Gidl, right, which is a sale and not a hiring. Low, right, but a case of hefker, you wouldn't be called a rasha, and so the case of the ani mahapech b'charara is not a case of hefker. Okay, and that's what now he says. Case number four: v'hainu tamanami demekach lememkar shayach dina devar metzra v'lo b'matana. And that's also why this whole halacha of dina bar metzra, right, selling to your neighbor, applies only by commerce and not by gifts. Now, new case, case five. What about the right? Hadamrinu cheskes habatim. Right, that whole case. There, the Jew who comes in and takes it before it gets transferred to the attempted purchaser is perfectly legitimate. Below Kemosha Pirish Ben Shmuel Dinikra Russia Kemo Ani Bem Hachipicharora. Right, and it's not like the Rashbam who says you're a Russia if you take advantage of that loophole. It's actually perfectly permissible, because it's actually perfectly permissible. So there's no problem, right? That is also a case of hefker, and hefker, he said, there's no issue. So that case is no problem. Case six. What about, you'll ask me about the fish? Latishu l'chay damri. Don't worry about the fish. And Rashi gives you his explanation of that case. Yesh l'chalek. You can distinguish the fish case. Dehavi kemosha yored l'umnos chaveru. It's as if you descend to your friend's thing, which is like case number seven, which is Rav Huna, the two people in the Mavoi, right? Who, one of whom puts a grindstone out. And Rabbi Meir also says, by the way, that there's a different way of explaining the fish case, because he thinks the way to explain the fish case, right, is the last line is the kemosha yuchal lifrosh kan mitzudaso, lifrosh kan mitzudaso, yuchal lifrosh mokom acher. That the fish case, even though it's hefker, is really like mecher, because just like you could buy it somewhere else, so too you can spread your net somewhere else. Okay, so that's right. So you see what Tosfot is, right? There are eight cases. There are eight cases, none of them reference each other, except for the fish and Rav Huna, and even then that's not so clear. And Tosfos puts them all together. It's one sugya. He has a number of distinctions. One distinction is between hefker and matan on one hand, and mecher and schiras on the other. Another distinction is between effort and lack of effort. A third distinction is between yored l'umanut and not yored l'umanut. And a fourth distinction, which may or may not be the same distinction as the one between hefker and matan on one side, and really should say hefker mitzia and matan on one side, and mekach and schiras on the other, is whether you can obtain the object in some other, right, an equivalent object in another way. No, wait, so I just want to show, there's a Tosfot. It's a long Tosfot. You can just read it. But now we've organized it, right? There are eight texts. There are four distinctions.
I'm missing one of them.
Yeah, what's eight?
Zero through three. His base text. Okay. His base text is zero. All right, and then there's numbers one through seven.
No, just the four categories. Sorry.
Oh, right. So there's hefker, mitzia, matana versus mekach umemkar and schirus. There's torach tvei versus not torach tvei. There is yored l'umanut chaveiro, and all we know about is not yored l'umanut chaveiro. And there is yochol limsov makom acher, and ino yochol limsov makom acher, which may or may not be the same thing as the first distinction. Okay, so here we have the Tosfot. You can organize it by text. You can organize it by distinctions. Okay, so what I gave you on the following two pages are two Tosafot that we did yesterday. Okay, that's pages 2 and 3. And what I want you to show, right, is that, right, say, this is how Tosafot, right, the way to think about Tosafot is that there's going to be a set of cases. So, right, so when you get another Tosafot in the same universe, right, so first of your research pattern is going to be to look up all the texts that a Tosafist cites, and then look up all the Tosafist commentaries on the text that he cites. Those texts will themselves cite other texts. Then you look up all the Tosafist commentaries on the on those texts, and eventually you'll hit a complete circle where they will stop quoting new texts.
Eventually.
So you're creating
case history. Yes. Right, but it'll circle back, right? So this is a fairly large number. Usually you won't even get up to this many texts. And usually, and you can check, right? Usually by the, and you'll learn patterns, right, which Tosafists you have to look in which things, but usually, fairly rapidly, you will get all the texts you need to understand the Tosafists. And then you're in really good shape, because the Tosafists pretty much cover the ground. Right? Not so many people are going to discover new texts that are relevant. So if you know all the texts that Tosafist cited, you're in pretty good shape about primary Talmudic sources. Now, later, you may, right, you know, when you get to later centuries, somebody may find a Yerushalmi, somebody may reintroduce Tosefta, things like that, but if you want basic Talmud Bavli sources, Tosafists are pretty good. Now, but I just gave you this massive research project. So here's the way of doing it. When you read it, right, if you're trying to figure out a particular idea, what you do is, when you find a new Tosfot, you say, let me look at all the texts in that new Tosfot, and let me look what he says about that text. So you can see, right, of the two Tosfot we did, so the first one, right, the first one never gets to 2, 4, 7, or 8, right, it's on page 2. It's just 0, 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. No, I guess it is 0, 1, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So you don't get 2 or 8.
There was no
0. 0, 0. 0, 0. So he just misses 2. Sorry, right? So he just misses 2. But then if you get to page 3, you'll see that I don't think he has a 1 or a 2 or a 4. And he introduces text 8 and 9.
Are these numbers
related
to cases or not?
Numbers of the cases. All right. So the first Tosfot leaves one out. Right. The Tosfot on page 2 leaves case 2 out. The Tosfot on page 3 introduces cases 8 and 9. Okay. So now we've collected. Right. So now we've collected 10 cases from these three Tosfot. So I'm going to show you on the following pages is. Now what I did was I just cut out the section of each Tosfot that dealt with each case. And now I can compare and contrast.
So I was just going to ask, like, at what point do you start caring what they're actually saying about each case? Is that this point that you start, that after you put them together?
Well, I read the first one closely. I might read the second and third one closely also, I might not. But at some point, right, at some point I can start skimming Tosfot, and the only thing I'm looking for is, does he say anything different in relationship to any of the texts I know about? Does he quote a text that I haven't yet seen? And since the Tosfot set the agenda for everybody thereafter, so you'll be able to read everyone in Ramban school pretty much the same way. Right? They'll say occasionally new things, and then when you get to Ramban, we'll see this right, which is Makaras today, you get to Ramban Rash Baritva. So Ramban sets the agenda. So the Rashba, when you have a Ramban, a Rashba, a Ritva, a Ran, a Nemuka Yosef, all of them, they're basically going to respond to the exact same questions about the exact same text. And each new person, very often you'll be lucky if you can find one new thing. Right? There'll be slightly nuanced formulation differences. Now you have to decide how, in Rosenzweig's terms, how seriously you take the distinctions in formulations. But you can skim the next ones, because you know what they're going to say. Right, they're not right. So you have to stop if you see them reading a new text, and if you see it right, if you see a formulation that's the same formulation, then you put in your head, okay, do I care about the nuances of formulations here? If you see a new substantive answer, which will always be the new substantive answer will always be right after a text, and you can see, is he using the keyword I recognized already, or is he using a different keyword? All right, and that way you can get through vast amounts of information. Much, much more rapidly than if you actually had to try to read each text independently, which, for your, you know, if you're writing your book, so then you want to read each text independently. But if you want to give, right, if you want to basically know the sugya and be ready for shir, prepare your own shir, but not on the book level, then you should be able to cover much more that way. Yes, Chaim. Rabbi Yosef is part of the. Pardon?
He's
a Ran student, right? It's just a chain of.
You haven't mentioned the Ran.
I did mention. I said Ramban, Rashba, Ritva, Ran, and Rabbi Yosef. Right, and then you have other people in that universe, right? You know, you have the Chiddush Rabbi David on some Masechtot, right? And which is not right, but and again, none of the, you know, and there are people which we'll see, like the Rush comes from, right? The Rush melds two schools. Right, so if you're the kind of person who likes doing chronological development, which I seem to be doing more of, even though I'm incompetent at it, right, so then you can have fun watching these two traditions merge and seeing how the next person has to deal with has to figure out which of the problems that bothered the earlier school he has to deal with. Like what I tried to show but I didn't do it well for you. I should do it in the Beit Din at the mikveh thing. So you have the Ramban solution. You have the Rif school, and you have the Tosfot school. And the way to understand Ramban is that Ramban is a combination of Tosfot and the Rif. Mm-hmm. And chronologically, what the Ramban says, which otherwise, if you were just reading the text, you can, as I think many people did, completely misunderstand the Ramban. But when you know what problems Ramban has to be responding to, because Ramban has in front of him, he has a Rif and he has a Tosfot. And these are the solutions he's working with, and you can just see that all he does is combine the two solutions. Yes?
Because I mean, just
there must be. I don't.
This won't be in my head 2 minutes from now.
Yeah, I'm.
And it would be an interesting thing. To
there must be a Rishonim short. So I believe it would be useful if somebody did a Mr. Spitzer put together a visual aid for students of more basic level, but just Rishonim trees.
There's a giant purple foldout book.
Okay, they need something that's probably a little bit more cut down. You also have the giant, right? Steinsaltz's has giant, or every book has this giant Amoraim, and who's school who? And some people know that. According to the Rivadim people, until you know that, you can't learn Gemara, so I can't learn Gemara. What can you do? I'm utterly incapable of knowing things like that. Okay, yes, Elliot.
So, with going to the Chokhmah Bumant, your statement that it's all based on the Rif and Tosfot, unless we're going to say the Ring Megas, is with the Rif.
Yeah, that's part of the school. Rif to Rimigash, Rif to Rimigash to Rambam.
If we had gone, did all the Tosfot, and done the Rif, and skipped the Rimigash, because that's not like a common...
Yeah, no, you have to, I say, on the Beit Din at the Mikveh Sugya, what matters was the Rif and the Tosfot, and that's what the Ramban did, and to some extent... Right, you understand the Rif better if you had the Bahag earlier, and that's the Nesiv's claim. The Nesiv's claim is right that you can't understand the Rif through Rambam school unless you have the Gaonim in context, because that's what they're reacting to. Again, if you want to be perfect, so you should always do that. Right, you should always do that. But
Here the Ramban would make any sense
without Rimigash. Yes, that's true, right? So I think you go through a school. Yeah, the school, the Rif through the Rambam school, which includes the Rimigash, but we only have the Rimigash on Bava Basra. Okay. Right, so it's not a... right, look at the Rimigash every Masechta, it would be great.
Are you proposing your own hierarchy of Rishonim?
No, I'm just proposing, this is a way... If you want to cover vast numbers of Rishonim, so if you know which school they belong to, then you're much more likely to be able to read them rapidly, because you know what's coming.
Do other people learn that there?
I think that's how Rosenzweig teaches you to read.
There were schools.
Okay, I don't know. They didn't teach me that way to Yeshiva, that there were schools.
In Malay Dunim, they'll say, you don't know a sugya unless you've learned the sugya through, four different Batei Midrash. They'll say, Ramban, Rash, Parva, you have to see the sugya from their perspective. Rambam, you have to see the sugya from this perspective. Tosfot, you have to see it from this perspective.
Right, so I have to say, I'm very bad at historical perspective. To me, so I'm just offering it as a technique for rapid reading.
They're not saying it historically, sir. They're just saying you don't know the sugya unless you've seen it through these four Batei Midrash.
Yeah, so it's also true, right? Because it's also true that that if you don't have context, that you end up reading the Rambam in light of Rashi, right? When he may have had a completely different basic understanding of the Gemara.
Yeah. Aside from the fact that Rambam is also often Matim Larashi, we have manuscripts of Rambam that are autographs where we see him correcting his Mishnah Torah to agree with Rashi.
I don't mind that he has Rashi, but he doesn't. You can't assume that the Rambam's pshat in the Gemara, right? Unless he says anything else is Rashi, the way you can with many later Rishonim, unless they say otherwise, their pshat is Rashi's. I don't think you can say that Rambam, his pshat is the Rif's. Right, that's or the Tziv says his pshat is the Gonim's.
The point of Shana was that it starts to change once Rambam gets Rashi.
That's very interesting. That's very likely. I'm fine with that. Okay, so just to take a look at right, so I did on the next page was I just lined up the text. So you'll see what kind of differences mostly minor differences show up. So for text, so let's say for in zero, so zero is interesting because in the first two texts, the distinction they right, what they're interested in text zero is that text zero is a case of Hefker, which works great for a Beit HaTam. That's why you're not called a Rasha in text zero. But then in the third one, he has a problem because there's another case of Hefker on a Menachef Rosh HaZayit that seems to be a problem. So he has to say this is a case of Hefker, but it's not enough that it's a case of Hefker. It's a case of Hefker in which there wasn't Tircha. All right, so he's responding. He's playing them off against different texts. In text one, you'll see that regarding that the first version of Tosfot is the Torach Batve, and the second one is Shetorach Bahani Lahapilam Laaretz V'Samchadat Alayu. So if I were in full of Rosenzweig mode, I would say, look, this is a radically different distinction. One of them talks about the quantity of Tircha. One of them talks about the psychological impact of the Tircha. Right? These are whole, right? They look like they're using the same words, but they're wholly different formulations. Right, is it Torach Batve? Is it just a measure of how much effort you put in? Or is it the effort plus the smichat dat? Is it the effort leads to smichat dat?
And I would say smichat dat is like Rashi's batuach,
though. Sure, right? I just want it, right? So I have these two formulations. I can exploit them or not as I choose. All right, if you take a look at text number three, so here, if we just go to the first version, that the first Tosfot just says, no, he's mistaker. So he can be mistaker somewhere else. The second Tosfot says that it's just a case of Oseb Bishar Eitzel Balabayit. He's being hired. But the third Tosfot says, Shemamsi Atzmo Eitzel Balabayit Lovdo Kneshi Yitain Lolif Amim Charar. So he changes it from a straight work relationship to this sort of importuning. So there again, you have room in the formulations to make a difference. In text four, it makes. Text 4, it makes no difference at all. In text 5, I don't think that there's much that makes a difference. In text 6, you can see that it's that the first two cases only use Yorid Lumnato. The second case has two different ways of the last Tosfot has two ways of distinguishing the fish case. The fish case is also a case of Yochel Lifros Mitzvah Tov Mekom Acher. And the second one is what everyone else says, which is Kemosh Yored Lum Nato. So if you want to eliminate the Yored Lum Nato distinction, so the first Teres of Tosfot here makes a difference. Because maybe it's not, maybe that he gives the first answer because he doesn't believe that Yored Lum Nato everybody agrees with. Right? So that's also something I can exploit if I want. Or I can say, look, everybody quotes Yored Lum Nato Teres. That must be the consensus position. Because every Tosfot quotes that, and so on and so forth. Text 7 is fundamentally the same. I want to point out about text 8 and 9. So text 8 and 9 are only show up in two or only one of the three . And here I want to point out one other methodological issue that we're going to have to address. I'm thinking I have to figure out practically. I wanted to spend at least one day doing sending you off to just build your own shir. I hope that'll be feasible. But so I wanted to point out one research avenue, right, for graduate students. To the best of my knowledge, no one has yet put together a comprehensive theory of Rabbeinu Tam on this issue.
That's Kami Reiner's dissertation.
Is it? On this?
On this issue. What issue?
The issue of anti-competitive regulation.
Oh no.
No, on the issue of right. So there are certain rishonim.
Sorry.
Okay, that's what I meant. All right. So on this issue, there is a core distinction Rabbeinu Tam makes, which is that he distinguishes between two kinds of cases. We've already seen two different formulations of that distinction. Right, whether it's about the kind of transaction or about whether the transaction can, whether you could accomplish the same thing somewhere else. We've seen the categories expand because you could just say Hefker Mecher, but then it became Hefker Metzia Matana versus Mecher and Schirus. And that happens in reaction to the introduction of new cases. Right, so his category keeps on getting more complicated. But it turns out that there actually are I think, 5 different distinctions in this sugya recorded the name of Rabbeinu Tam. They are not congruent with these. And the thing about Rabbeinu Tam is we don't have his book. All we have is the report. We don't have anything in Sefer Yashar that is a full treatment, leaving aside whether Sefer Yashar is in any way his book. Right, the Sefer Yashar we have. So we have is lots of reports from Rabbeinu Tam, some of which contradict. And the issue, right, to really understand Rabbeinu Tam, it's possible that all these positions are interrelated. So we saw, for example, that his explanation may depend on how you physically understand the fish case. Right? Because the fish case, right? Because either the distinction in terms of effort or the distinction in terms of hefker, we need some way to say that the fish case is a problem. We're actually going to turn out to be multiple. Right? There are at least 3 ways of dealing with the fish case. One is the fish case is a hefker thing, but you could do it somewhere else. Right? Another is the fish case is a hefker case, but it involves a lot of bother. A third is the fish case is only according to Rav Huna, and we don't paskin that way. Now, it turns out that in all these texts, there will be reports of how Rabbeinu Tam dealt with them. And in some of them, he will have totally different understandings of the case in order to get to that. So it might, right? So to my knowledge, all the treatments of Rabbeinu Tam so far have atomized him and really just dealt with those 2 issues. But some people have a third issue, which we'll see. The third issue is whether you are called a Rasha in the Metziah case, I think. Right, so that's already 3 things Rabbeinu Tam has, a definition, right? The reality of the fish case, whether you're called a Rasha in the Metziah case, the distinction between Hefker and the other. And we'll see that there are, as we go through Rishonim, there are more and more places where Rabbeinu Tam is quoted and keeps on saying different things. We don't know if they're all reliable. So, whole new avenue. The Rambam doesn't offer us any kind of systematic solution at all. Right? So the only way to get the Rambam together is you have to look up the Rambam on each of these texts and then try and figure out how do you read the text and then write your own Tosfot on the Rambam. Right, that's another your own exercise in doing it. Right? If you have multiple texts, that's the only way. Right? That's the only way to compare Rambam to Tosfot is to follow the Rambam around Tosfot's track. So I'll just put that out there. Right? Those are spaces where, after I give you all the sources, there's still a tremendous amount of work to do. Those are research patterns. I don't think that's been done yet either. I haven't seen a comprehensive treatment of the Ramos position.
Does I have to like break it down and like write a machine learning computer program
to do all this? Eventually, I imagine, but I don't know a machine that's been trained to understand Rabbinic Hebrew. It's not so hard, but I don't think to understand Rabbinic Hebrew is an easy language. So if you can train a computer to read English, you can certainly train a computer to read Rabbinic Hebrew. But those are research patterns. What you'll find, right, so you get the secondary literature, and I would suggest that you try to read at least one of the summary articles before The Economist come if you have a chance tonight. So you'll see that most people don't do this. Most people, what they'll do is they'll take a secondary source which already organizes the material for them. This is a tremendous research project. Right? And one of the things to understand is, right, so it's one thing to have a PhD, another thing to be a POSIG. When you can get asked a question like this every day on a different topic. So POSIGs on the whole don't have the luxury of running a 6-week program with a team of graduate students to begin their approach to the question. So they're going to use secondary sources. Mm-hmm. Right, so they'll take out an article like Rabbi Jaffer's article, who will, right, in turn, he'll quote the acronym. And then, you know, and the question is, so if what you want to do is you want to present the halakha as it is now, the conventional answer, so that is the right way to do it. But there's opportunities to revisit it, because it will turn out that the halakha as it is always going to, right, as we showed again in the Beit HaNekvah thing, it'll turn out that there are sources that the Beit Yosef didn't have. And you can reopen the conversation there. Okay.
Well, that's assuming you can.
Assuming you can. Yes. Or so first is the Chavos Yerod. You can always assume that you just say Halacha Kevasrei, and whatever we didn't have was Siyata Dishmaya we didn't have. And so it just disappears into the dustbin of history, or the...
Unless you think
of the Olam HaYeshiva Sheina Kehalacha.
Right.
Right. All possible. Not interesting, though.
Interesting doesn't always make it right.
That's true. Being interesting doesn't always make it right.
I know, right?
Usually I talk about epistemologically there are three models of truth. And there's coherence, right? Everything has to make sense with itself. There's correspondence, it has to match something you already know to be true. And there's coolness. Sometimes I like the coolness theory of truth. Not always. Like, Shlomo Kluger was cool. I'm not sure that that's always the...
How about novelty? Is that like
a... No, because it'd be silly, right? Because silly is not true.
Or, no, like, but it's so, original that you have to believe it.
I know the originality per se. It has to be brilliant, not just original. Right? Who can say something original and dumb? Like no one intelligent would ever have thought of that. It's highly original. Originality per se. There are things that are just wrong. Right, and they're original because they should be original, because no one should ever have said them. That's different then. So now, I think the more challenging, right, coolness is fun, but I think the more, and I think there is power to that, which is parallel to elegance in physics. Maybe, I suspect some physicists probably have a coolness thing also, and it's not just elegance.
Elegance is definitely used to judge how convincing, at least in biology, also.
Yes, elegance is certainly a criteria also, but I think there's room for coolness as such. But I also think the real issue is that the one we keep bringing up is correspondence. Is correspondence to what? It says correspondence to ethics, correspondence to practicality, correspondence to theories of the world, correspondence to what the last posek said. Right, those are very different notions of correspondence, and I think that a halachic theory has to integrate correspondence to all of them. And that opens up correspondence to historical truth. This one, Rav Schechter is much more radical than I am. Rav Schechter thinks historical truth is halacha, and errors don't count. If someone made a demonstrable error, then it just gets undone.
Yeah, but he's a very high bar for demonstrable.
He does.
Except when he doesn't want to.
Right, and this is parallel to the Rebbe Tumbers. You have to know all of a person's positions, because I can just take that one position of Rav Schechter and build the whole universe, and all that matters is historical truth. And it turns out that he's going to advocate nothing but, first of all, manuscript study is the first thing you have to do. Right, for reading any sugya, then you have to draw all the Rishonim in chronological order. Right, that's the obvious methodology, and that doesn't actually work out because his position is tied into a premise that there are very few mistakes. Right, and it's hard. And if you hold, it's difficult to hold both the position that historical truth is koveya and that there are lots of mistakes, right? Because that destabilizes halacha in a way which
is. But if we have evidence that there are lots of mistakes.
So then it might be that you need to abandon your position, right? So usually, people who think there are lots of mistakes end up with a claim that halacha doesn't change just because you discovered a mistake. Usually, those two positions go together. The more mistakes you are, the less you think they matter.
I don't want to attack people, but I don't get how there are so many. We have a lot of manuscripts now that show that there are a lot of times where we passion based on a manuscript error, but I don't think we're going to change all of those times we passion that way.
So you're making a premise that you think the manuscript shows, but maybe those manuscripts were found in the Geniza because they were mistaken. These are all rest on epistemological assumptions, and they all generate. Somebody might hold that because he says, "Oh my goodness, I'm really convinced halakha has to be historically true, and I know halakha can't be destabilized, so it must be that methodology is wrong because they see them as intimately connected."
It's the famous case of Mishnah.
About
the Gemara says, quotes number one says, "I was in Rome and I saw the tzitz, and it was written Kodesh Lashem one line." And the Ram Paskins, you write Kodesh, I think below with Lashem above and on different lines.
Yeah.
And then the Kesef Mishnah asks, the Rambam's against the Gemara. He says, "No, who says the tzitz that they found?"
Yeah, there's a real tzitz. This is a solution you can always pull out, and then you have to decide for yourself which is the most elegant.
Like the Ramban, multiple times he changed his understanding
Shamash after he arrived here at Yisrael.
Because he saw the archaeology was different.
But it turned out he was a much better understander of what words meant.
Than as an archaeologist. Right? That is also a... that's also...
He misidentified... He saw that Kever Rachel was much closer to Yerushalayim than his Perush.
So, again, when rabbis start dabbling in science often, you know, the ones who want to be close to the science often get the science wrong and would be better off interpreting interpreting the entire thing. That's often true, that you're better at the, you're better at your specialty than you are at
field.
See, you'll
have to sell my guy. I get all my science from Victor Miller.
Ah, well then. No way to respond to that. There's just no way to respond to that. So I tend to try and develop, you know, more composite notions, like halakha has, like a frame, I think it was Talat Chaim, but I think halakha is an inertial principle. So the halakha stays the way it is, right, unless a fairly strong force comes to push against it. And that lets me keep the halakha, exactly the way it is in all the areas I haven't researched. And since, as you can tell, it takes me a very long time to research a topic, so halakha is not going to change so rapidly. But other people have, and even when, you know, sometimes, you know, I try and point out regularly that, you know, that, so let's say, and again, taking that shir as a paradigm, that sometimes we discover that we really don't want the halakha to change. Right? Like, so we might be really happy if the Shulchan Aruch really says that all such geris, you know, that it doesn't matter the beitins of the mikveh, everyone agrees the geris is kasher b'dieved. So we might not want to know that that's not pshat in the Rishonim he was quoting. And they're off, so maybe that, you know, there's a moral inertial force also, because the consequences of changing the law are too radical. Yes, ma'am?
Aren't we always filtering our decisions about
through
which one is more
mistaber? Is mistaber a coherence theory or a correspondence theory or a coolness theory? What does mistaber mean?
So, I mean, this whole mahalach was going with a correspondence theory.
The historical accuracy is a correspondence theory. And you have to pick your fixed point in time, right? I want halacha to be exactly what it was in Provence in 1136 or whatever it may be. And that's probably, you know, you have Jews who want to be Second Temple Jews, and Jews who want to be First Temple Jews, Jews who want to be Rambam Jews. Pardon? No, I don't think that. I don't think we want to go there. I don't think we ever think that was ever a point. Okay. So with all that, by the way of extended introduction, now let's look at the Ramban. Okay. So the Ramban. So this is the right the Makaris that you were referred on. Ramban says, Shani Dagim Dehayavisira. So again, I want you to see, right, so when I learn now, I think computers are a boon. So if you have a text that quotes multiple people, so the first thing is just to break out the voices in the text. Alright, so Ramban on this breaks down into, right, there's the Aruch's position and there's Rashi's position. Now if you take a look, that the contribution I think he makes is he has this, right, is that he actually turns the fish case into Gezel Gamur. And if the fish case is Gezel Gamur, so then it turns it, right, so then you can remove it from all conversations about Hefker, not Hefker. Right, it's a totally irrelevant case. It's really Gezel. If it's really Gezel, then it has no relationship to our topic at all. Yes, right, maybe. Right, if you, right, you know, he uses that word. He uses Ki Gezel. Friend? It says Ki'ilu Gezel Adayin, doesn't it?
Who says
Rashi
the Kilo,
right?
So you could read it back and say that, right, and say that, but since Gezel Gamor, you know, it, right, uses language that none of us has seen, you can try and read it back and say, you know, so this teaches us that maybe Ani Mahapei Pecharara is also Gezel Gamor. Well, according to whom, right? You can try to read it. The underlying, right, the conceptual question is whether the issue in terms of limiting competition is taking something when you're not supposed to. Is that called gezel, or is it some other kind of some other kind of issue. So he says, Gesell Gilmores, if you think he's still in the realm of competition, right, so then this teaches us that all cases of competition are somewhere on, of problematic competition are somewhere on the realm of Gesell. Or you can say that the purpose of saying Gesell Gilmores is to say that this is unrelated to competition. Right, this case is wholly, right, and this is in the Teretz, right, this is explaining why this is different than Rav Huna. Right, so maybe it just says, oh, no, that's different, but you look, the fish was in his thing, and you took it, right, that's just Gesell. Right, and that doesn't tell me anything about whether you can restrict somebody else from competing with you. Right, those are the two ways of reading it. Yes, Elliot? Okay. Okay. So now, let's, I'm going to skip the rest of the page number that was in the small, that was in the small print. At some point, we should go back and do all the, and do all the, Mavoi Chatzir Girsa issues, but I think that we're going to be able to largely handle the sugya without, without going into them. Again, Mavoi and Chatzir are not really useful categories in modernity anyway. So that's right. So it may be possible to create conceptual analogs without figuring out what particularly the sugya says. Maybe. So the next page it says Upasku Gaonim Zalak Rav Huna Breider of Yeshua Upligid Rav Huna. So the Gaonim said that we paskin by Gaonim. I don't know if he means what we mean by Gaonim. Just be careful about that. I'm not sure that he's consistent. It certainly goes through the Rif, I think. I'm a rotten historian. So they go in and paskin like Rav Huna Breider of Yeshua, Upligid Rav Huna, and they understand Rav Huna Breider of Yeshua as disagreeing with Rav Huna. The Ika Ditzmiyale, but there's some people who find this astonishing. I pligad Rav Huna, hechi amar pshitale. If Rav Huna Breider of Yeshua was disagreeing with Rav Huna, how could he say pshitale? So Yesh pointed out that there are other cases like this in Shas. But nonetheless, there are some people who thought this was weird. So, Upirshu B'Shem Rabbeinu Tamzal. So they explain the name of Rabbeinu Tam. The Rav Huna Breider of Yeshua Lav Aumnos Koi, Ela Amine Schora, Benyana de Amroye Vigrogros, Ela Aumnos Kavua, Matzim Ake. So that Rabbeinu Tam has a whole new position in this sugya. What's Rabbeinu Tam's new position?
Sales and crafts.
And what's the difference between sales and crafts? You can be.
You cannot be me'akev on the seller, but you can be me'akev on the craftsman.
Yes, right. That the ability, right. And Tom now introduces a distinction that says that the right to prevent competition applies to crafts, but not to sales. Okay, that's a whole new distinction, and that shapes his understanding, right, of this text, and that may, right, that may or may not interact with his understanding of the, right, of all the, of all the other cases. Isn't that right? Pardon? Based on a Gemara.
Yeah.
Which one?
There's a Gemara that says that if you review it as a shita that you can't, that you, when you need to teach someone a manut, it's dafka on manut and not schora. Or it's not iska.
Yes, that's true.
So it's like there's a difference between these things. The same way he says you could find this anywhere else, he's now saying a schora could be sochar anything. Sochar is a schora.
Aha, okay. So that's an interesting connection. I agree the distinction between Umanut and Schora is not a radical chiddush on his part. So you're right, you're saying A, that he's getting it from that Gemara, and B, what it means in that Gemara is this. Right? That's a reasonable.
What it means in that Gemara is that Umanut is praiseworthy and Schora is
it? Yes.
Is not.
Yes. That's what it means. So that, right, I think that your connection to that Gemara is very reasonable. I think your explanation of the Gemara is reasonable. So
it may
we
not work here.
It may or may not be true.
Okay.
But it's very reasonable. Very, right? And Rabbeinu Tam rarely makes stuff up. Right? What he does is he draws connections.
Yes.
Yes.
I would take it further than Avi and say that for something in that Gemara, it's supposed to be like this, is because it's unreliable. And for sure, the definition is unreliable, which is why you don't really get through mocking people.
Okay, that could be also, right? And we can build all sorts of theories.
Yes.
Right? And depending, but this may or may not interact with Rabbeinu Tam's distinction, right, claim about competition, right, and what kind of competition, right, whether competition be hefker as opposed to.
It does. He already extends the idea of competition to. We thought the idea of. We keep saying competition and compares it to buying and selling.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's not just. And he says that the selling is competition with the ability to have a job. And so what's the job that you're having? Is the job that you're having something that you can have anywhere, or something that is unique? Is it they're a commodity job or non commodity job?
All right, but he says the other way, but it's the other way, the way you wouldn't expect it. He says that there is there is a problem with competing about Schora. Right, the way you would expect him to say there isn't a problem competing about Schora, but he says there is a problem competing about Schora because the other person can get it wherever he wants. Right, so he frames it totally in terms of the second person, not in terms of the first, which is not necessarily the way you would construct it on your own. And then, by the way, Ramban rejects this out of hand.
But we also didn't see a Ben Yerushalmi that this distinction, did we?
We haven't previously seen a Ben Yerushalmi making this distinction. But if it's accurate, then Rabbi Natan's position may have been connected, but now along comes the school of Ramban, and they accept one of it, not the other. So they really could be creating a wholly new position. Right, Rabbi Natan's positions may have been interconnected the way, let's say, Rav Schechter's positions about the prevalence of error and the impact on halacha of error are probably connected. And what happens is somebody comes along and says, well, you know what? I completely disregard Rav Schechter's claim about the rarity of error, but I'm wholly convinced by his position about the halakhic impact of error.
So, are you going to trust that the Ramban is fair to presume they're not connected?
Could be. I don't know. Ramban's rejection of one of them is textual. Right, he rejects this position because he thinks it's not a good.
And yet he doesn't reject the other. So therefore, he either assumes that they can stand alone, or he assumes they're not.
Yes, he assumes they can stand alone. I assume that those two positions can stand independently. Also, it doesn't mean, right? So that is the fair question. This is, I guess, the question where Luchenstein is reading of Rishonim. Right. So it is fair for me to say, it's fair for Ramban to say that he is following Rabbeinu Tam's distinction between Hefker and Matana, but it may not be fair to say that he is pasquining like Rabbeinu Tam, because he may not have Rabbeinu Tam. Right. He can be convinced by Rabbeinu Tam, but not have Rabbeinu Tam's authority necessarily, because having Rabbeinu Tam's authority, you might have to accept the whole kit and caboodle.
Rav Schechter
would give
a share on that.
Doesn't surprise me.
Because Rav Schechter, someone asked this, and Rav Schechter made a whole share of it. Someone asked such a good question. Because the rule is, right, if we don't assume you have to pass in like the same Rishon every single time in life, right?
But how do you know which positions are interconnected?
But Rav Schechter holds everything's interconnected. Uh-huh. That's his main yisod. So how do you ever just to paskin other than going through all shas and every single sheet, which Rav Schechter I think holds, you do need to be able to paskin.
Right.
So that might make it all irrelevant. But no, so it always says, if they don't appear to be directly connected,
uh-huh,
if the connection is going to be much more subtle and something might weigh in on it, but if it's not a direct connection, so usually you can tell when it's directly, if it's from the same text, if it's related in the Gemara, you can usually tell whether a source is...
Okay, so he's trying to develop a complex theory. It's the Dirk Gently understanding of halacha. Torito, right, Dirk Gently believes in is a detective who believes in interconnected, in Douglas Adams, believes in the interconnectedness of everything. So to investigate, all he has to do is do anything. And eventually.
No, those things are, like, not good.
Sorry?
What?
You don't like those. They're not as good. No, they're not as good.
I
don't quote them as canon. But they grow on me. They grew on me after, like, on the third or fourth reading.
Maybe that's, like, the interconnectedness.
Okay. Yes.
Do you have a svara for how they might be connected?
I could construct one, but I don't see any reason to yet. Because there are more. Alright, that very next line. Zilu zavna shirichu teichu. Pirish rabbinu tamzal. Lav shirichu teichu bilchud kamar. The yachil lamachar hein mesim birov. Rabbinu tam has this whole fun position, right? We don't want to reduce people to have, right, to living hand to mouth. They want people to be able to make a secure living. Right? Elashir vichu kidei chiyutaychu. They can make a profit. Right? Enough to be able to live on in the future. This is a whole problem in Hilchot Staka, right? The problem with means testing. And we have actually a very complicated solutions to figure out how you can avoid means testing from keeping people completely in poverty. And basically the solution is that if you're that public charity is never supposed to give you security because we want there to be a hazard, but private charity you can collect enough to get, right, enough to generate security, even if you're on a private collecting trip and you exceed our means test for accepting charity, you're allowed to finish your trip because we don't want to put people in the welfare cycle where the moment you hit that, right, you lose your welfare and then you're back in, right, and then you make another dollar and run and circle. So that there's lots of capital
and get back, so you can invest it.
Yeah, there's really a whole set of really nice tshuvot trying to figure out how to deal with that issue. Yes, Jenna.
So, I don't know why, but
I just get a feeling like when he's talking about this that he's expecting them to stay quite a while. He cares about them making, like, you know, like, I mean, someone who's staying for a week, like, that's
right, it wouldn't be such a big deal. But
right, so it must be because he's expecting you to stay for like a year or whatever.
Because really, you're trying to collect your debts, right? Okay, so you're trying to collect your debts. If people haven't paid you on time, then you're likely going to be there for quite some time.
Right. Okay.
Think about a court case.
Yeah, right, you could be, right? So, yes, very likely, once you're stuck, you're stuck. Okay, and Ratan goes further, right? Elish, right, the Alpi Bezdin, V'ein Medachtikin Bedavar Lahachmer Aleim Yoser Midai. So actually, Ratan thinks there's a regulatory mechanism. They should go to court, and the court should tell them, apparently, how much they're allowed to make. But he gives instructions to the court. But be generous, right? So this is right. So this moves from an understanding of the sugya to a whole public policy statement.
Mm-hmm. Or he could be understanding the sugya as Shir Chai Taichu is the most generous possible share that we could give you.
I don't know how you get that into the words of Chai Taichu.
Whoa.
That'd be a lot of words. If you know, to claim it's textually motivated, would be a lot.
Right.
Right. More likely, it's he has a very robust conception of what's necessary for commerce. And he doesn't want to discourage people from engaging in international commerce. And if you tell people that if you engage in international commerce and you're ever held up with the place where you travel, right, you're going to live hand to mouth. So you're not going to do it. So right, so he creates a judicial policy that is intended to be friendly to international commerce. Yes,
you could say that Lothar Mason Barav is saying, but Shir Chai Taichu can't possibly be that he's living hand to mouth because then that wouldn't guarantee that you could survive.
Would guarantee that you could survive.
So Shir Chai Taichu must mean that it will enough to
keep you alive. Right. Then you could have minimal profit, right? You could say you could make Shir Chai Taichu plus 10% daily. But I think it's really he wants to make them comfortable.
The only interesting what they're accustomed to making, like they're run a business, they're used to making profit,
So that's fine. But he said,
I'm saying that would be a textual. Then you could say that he means.
Sure, but I don't want to. There's three steps. There's Chir Taichu, right, which means enough to live. Then there's that doesn't mean enough to live daily. That means enough to live long term. Then it means and that amount. Then that amount is set formally by a court, right? And then it's but the court should be generous, right? So we've moved.